BDNG podcast. My name is Tina McKenzie and I am the Education Development Lead for the BDNG. I hope you enjoy listening to the BDNG podcast and find them beneficial to your practice. These podcasts are sponsored by Amaril. Amaril has no influence over the content of these podcasts. Happy listening. Welcome everyone to another BDNG Meets podcast. My name is Tina McKenzie and I'm the Education and Development Lead for the BDNG. So today I have great pleasure in introducing Dr. Christopher Sargent again, who's already done a podcast for us. And today he is the Medical Director of Pathway. So today we're going to be talking about Pathway. So welcome again, Dr. Chris. How are you?
Thank you. Thanks for having me back. Yeah, very well. Thank you. Very well.
Good, good. So the last time we've done a series now, we've done a few podcasts now on sort of the homeless aspects, and we've had some signposting, we've had lived experience, we've had experts like yourselves. So today we invited you back and you very kindly suggested that we talk about Pathway and what it is and what it offers, and just to sort of enrich our listeners today on what it is all involved. So yeah, could you begin just by explaining what is Pathway?
Yeah, sure, thank you. So Pathway's a charity, homelessness and inclusion health charity. So it was started about 12, 14 years ago now, shortly after the death of a patient who was homeless, who was discharged from UCH and died quite soon after discharge. And that sort of prompted a lot of soul searching and investigation by the hospital at UCH. And the founder of Pathway, a gentleman called Professor Aidan Halligan, who sadly now died a few years ago, sort of looked into all of this and thought we must be able to do better than getting people into hospital, patching them up, putting them back out onto the street, and then them either getting ill or in the worst cases dying. So he came up with this idea of having an in-reach team with a GP who's experienced in homelessness and health, a nurse who knows the hospital well, a housing worker, an input from lived experience, putting those people into a hospital to find support during the admission, and most importantly plan the discharge of the person who's experiencing homelessness in hospital. Because historically what happened was people were treated and then either discharged themselves when things were not going well, or they were discharged out, but people often didn't know that they were homeless until the time came for discharge, and then it was too late and they were just discharged anyway. So it was to try and sort of improve that situation.
Yeah, I mean, I'm really sorry to hear about the, you know, the death of the patient as well, and it must have taken a lot of soul searching and, you know, planning as well, you know, and amazing what you, your faculty and yourself have all you know, put together. And I think as a clinician, it is very difficult, you know, if you do get a patient in that's struggling or homeless, and what to do, and maybe even avoid the question, you know, of you know, delving a bit more into the situation because you don't know what to do. So yeah, it's great to have these things.
I think that's exactly right. I think people sort of don't want to open the box, open the question, because they're worried about what they might find, and it's easier perhaps not to know or to leave it to somebody else to sort out. But we think that by finding out about a person, doing a sort of proper full assessment of the person's needs, taking into account their physical needs, their mental health needs, if they have needs around dependencies, and their housing need and their care needs, all of those things together, it's only really by addressing all of those things together that you can actually make some proper progress for the person. So that's what our teams try to do. So the first team was at UCH. We then launched the next two teams, one of which was the team I worked in for many years in Brighton. The other one was at the Royal London Hospital, which is also still going. Those started about 12 years ago. And those were part of a clinical trial, a two-centre clinical trial, where we trialled normal care, which is what you get, you know, from the hospital, and then the other arm of the trial was pathway care, to compare the two to see what the differences were. And the differences were pretty remarkable. There was much reduced discharge out with nowhere to go. So in the normal care arm, that was about 15, 17% of people. In the pathway arm, it was about 2 to 3% of people. There were much improved health outcomes for people and much improved housing outcomes as well. So not only were people not going out to sleeping on the street, but people who'd come in from, say, sofa surfing were going out to better accommodation. So people's overall health was being improved, and their housing situation was being improved as well. And those two things are inextricably linked, that it's very difficult to be healthy if you haven't got somewhere decent to live. And if you haven't got somewhere decent to live, or you're sleeping out on the street, your health will suffer. We know it always suffers. We know the health outcomes are really bad for people in the homelessness and health inclusion groups, with, average age of death of people sleeping out on the street is in the mid-40s, and we know that the standardized mortality ratios are about 10, so 10 times the death rate you'd expect for the person's age in the homeless and inclusion health groups.
Gosh, I mean, that's so young, isn't it? The age, in the 40s, and to have some structure then. You mentioned sofa surfing as well, and that's something I think is becoming a lot more common, isn't it? Definitely in the area I work in, it's definitely a big issue, and something I'd never thought of there, because I felt that you've really sort of incorporated both homelessness and sofa surfing, which before I thought maybe be a bit more separate. If they had a sofa to be on, then that would be okay. But that's a good point that you've really raised there, and it is
I think
important.
it's really stressful for people if they don't know where they're going to be able to sleep tonight. And staying
Absolutely.
with friends sounds okay, but you don't know if that's going to if that's a situation that's going to change very suddenly. They might want somebody else to come home with them, and then you're out. We know there are lots of people in very sort of unsuitable arrangements, so they might be being able to stay somewhere, swapping. They might be paying some rent, they might be paying in other ways, they might be paying in doing housework, they might be paying in sex. And that's a really sort of really unsuitable way to be living, that you don't know if the next day the person might say, actually, I don't want you staying here anymore, you've got to go, and then you are back on the street again. And our teams will see people who are people obviously who are rough sleeping, people who are sofa surfing, people in emergency accommodation, because that can be cancelled on the day as well. People living in suitable places, so people living in cars, garages, sheds, barns, whatever it might be. People living permanently in a tent. So people have probably seen more people around the streets now who are with, sort of tents outside shops and things, rather
Yeah,
than
that's
people
true.
sleeping outside. So that all of those people will all be seen by pathway teams, because we think there are improvements that can be made in those people's situations.
Well, that's a huge, benefit for these patients that, well, people that are out there, and like you say, the differences as well is really very important, and very vulnerable, aren't they, when people are on the streets and susceptible to so much exposure
Yeah,
of.
and a lot of exploitation as well. If if you're in a desperate situation, you have to do things that you wouldn't want to do in order to survive and in order to keep your accommodation. So, as I say, there's all sorts of arrangements going on, but they all put people at risk.
Before we delve into a bit more of the pathway, just focusing on people that are in this situation, do you find it's all ages, like even very young people, or families even, or is there a difference?
So there's increasing numbers of families in emergency accommodation, people in what are called B&B, but it's probably a room in a big building that's been split up into small rooms. So lots of people living in those situations, people in those situations with children. So all ages are affected, because obviously children are affected in that way. In terms of the rough sleeping population, the people you see tend to be in the sort of 20 to 40 age group, because people die young, so they don't make it into the 50s and 60s. And again, the visible people tend to be men, but we know that the lifetime risk of homelessness is the same for men and women. So it may be that women are better at hiding themselves away because it's much riskier for women, or it may be that women are better at finding sort of temporary places to stay, you know, through the arrangements that I was sort of talking to about earlier. So yes, it affects both sexes, all ages. People from ethnic minority groups are at higher risk of homelessness as well. Everybody's affected.
Everyone's affected, yeah, and you know, quite frightening when you hear some of the stories as well, isn't it? It's like you say, you know, you want to help, but it can be very difficult for clinicians as well. And focusing on the differences here, you know, you mentioned obviously people being in hospital, you mentioned people sofa surfing, and then obviously we've got people that are on the streets that we all pass, we all see. So how does Pathway help? Is it like categorized into, you know, clinicians getting in touch with yourselves, or is it people that are going to see people on the streets, or do people on the streets go somewhere? How does it work?
So the Pathway Partnership Program is about helping areas to improve, particularly in hospital care and discharge for people experiencing homelessness. So that's the sort of core of our business. But a lot of our teams have found over the years, as I said, my team in Brighton, it's been going for about 12 years now. They need to make strong links out into the community as well. So after about a year, we realized that we needed people who could follow up our patients after they were discharged into accommodation to make sure that they were supported in the community, make sure that they maintained their accommodation, were able to go to their health appointments as well. And some of the teams have a very strong sort of community aspect as well. So they work in the community, they enrich into day centres and see people in clinics in the community, as well as going into the hospital. But for hospital, we think that the hospital kind of admissions act as a kind of sieve for the neediest people. So they're people who are homeless, but they're also ill. You don't get into hospital unless you're really sick these days. So if you're homeless and you end up in hospital, then you really do need the help. It also means that you've got good evidence that you can give to housing authorities, the local authority housing department, to say, this person's in priority need because of their health problems. We know they're from this area because they're in this hospital. And we've got good, you know, we've able to gather good evidence together to make the case for them to be housed when they're discharged. Because there's lots of, people may not know, there's lots of criteria that you need to sort of meet in order to be housed by the local authority. You have to be meet priority need. So you need to have sort of something seriously wrong with you health-wise. You need to be from the local area or have a local connection. So there are various other ones that you need to meet as well. But not everybody who goes to ask for help from a housing department will be housed. A lot of people will have been repeatedly to try and be housed and been turned away. So hospital admission is a really good opportunity to change that and to put things on a different path.
Yeah, really, it's a huge amount of, you know, work, isn't it? I mean, it's quite, you know, thought provoking when you think about all of it.
It's a bit different to yeah, what clinicians are used to doing. But in fact, once you get your connections going and once you've got your system mm-hmm. going, it's not that difficult, but somebody yeah. needs to do it. So I think the problem we have in a lot of places is that clinicians don't think it's their job, but then it's yeah. nobody else's job either. It's not the job of adult social care. It's not the job of therapy people. It's nobody's job. So that's why the Pathway team's going in. It is their job. That's what they do. They help the ward teams sort of gather the information, make the applications, do the planning, while also supporting the person experiencing homelessness themselves, because the teams understand, you know, the world that person has come from, what it's like out there for those people living on the street. And it can be really horrible for people experiencing homelessness to be in hospital. It's completely different to what they're used to. people are talking in a kind of clinical language that they don't understand. Often they don't know what's happening with their care. They sometimes feel, you know, discriminated against by the staff, who perhaps also don't think they should be there. Sometimes things like alcohol withdrawal and drug withdrawal are not well treated, which makes people feel unwelcome and unwell. So we think a lot of the self-discharge, so very high self-discharge rates among people experiencing homelessness, in some places up to 20% of admissions. With the general population, it's 1 or 2%. So something's happening, which means that people experiencing homelessness are not getting what they need when they're admitted to hospital. And some of that does boil down to not having a sort of wide-eyed look at things. So we might be looking at the fractured tibia or whatever it is, but we're not looking at the mental health needs. We're not looking at the alcohol withdrawal. We're not looking at the need for opiate replacement therapy, the things that perhaps aren't well done in an acute setting are the things that people experiencing homelessness really need.
Yeah, I mean, that is, and I think as well, you know, just a quick question before I want to ask a bit more, but how big are your pathway teams? I mean, when you mentioned the teams, what staff have you got on these teams?
So a kind of a basic team, which is a team that we say is needed in a hospital that has 200 admissions a year of people experiencing homelessness, would be a part-time GP, maybe 2 days a week, who works at a local homelessness service, a full-time nurse, and a full-time housing officer. Then we'd also, the next stage would be to have somebody with lived experience in the team as well. So, you know, a sort of peer, care navigator type role. Then some of the teams have physiotherapists, occupational therapists, some have psychologists, depending on the size of the population of people experiencing homelessness coming to the hospital, the number of admissions, then the teams vary in size, but a sort of classic pathway team would be about four people, something like that. They might not all be full-time, different disciplines, and we find that the more disciplines involved, the better the team is.
Yeah, because I hadn't realized that as well. You know, another good point you've made there about, you know, even physios in the team as well, and you know it's something I would never have known about that. So Chris, you mentioned that obviously there is hospitals that have got pathway there. And obviously people in, you know, staff in that hospital can access, that's not a problem. What about other areas? How does that work? Or is there anything that, you know, say my hospital, for example, if I come across this situation, what would I do?
Sure. So you're right. We have, there are five teams in our partnership program at the moment, and about 20 teams around the country who've been through the program at some point, but all the other trusts don't have pathway teams in. Some will have housing workers who work in the discharge team, but we think that work needs to start sort of right when at the beginning of the admission. So there are things that everybody can do, and there are some things that people ought to be doing. So the duty to refer is a legal duty on hospitals and other public bodies to inform the local authority if a person experiencing homelessness is in their institution, so admitted to hospital. So everybody should be making duty to refer referrals. The way to do that is to send an email to the duty to refer department. You can find that address on the local authority's website in your area. It's usually duty to refer at, so in Brighton, it's brighton-hove.gov.uk, but it will be similar to that for other places. And what they need is the person's name, date of birth, national insurance number, and where they are, and a way of contacting them. Obviously, you have to get the person's consent first before you send that information. Once the local authority have that information, they should then contact the person and offer help to relieve their homelessness. So that's one thing that everybody can do and everybody should be doing. As I say, it's a legal duty on hospitals, many of whom are not doing that at the moment. The other thing people can do is refer to an organization called StreetLink. So there's a website, thestreetlink.org.uk, which you can find easily. That has an interactive map on it where you can mark where a person is sleeping rough. So if you know somebody's saying being discharged from A&E and they're going to be sleeping rough, you can ask them. Again, you need their permission. Say where are you likely to be sleeping. If they can tell you where that's going to be, you can mark that on a map. Give a contact number as well, because people often hide themselves away from their exact sleeping site. And then the next outreach service from that local authority will go and try and find that person and make contact with them. So that's something that everybody can do. And that doesn't necessarily need to be a person who's admitted to a hospital. That could be anybody that's sleeping rough. Other things you can do is sort of put together packs. So packs of information can be really useful. So if you have people experiencing homelessness coming into your hospital or your A&E, then knowing where they can go to get registered with a GP will really help them, and also will help them not have to come back to A&E next time they're ill. Where the local day centre is, or places that do food, so soup runs and things like that can be really helpful. When the weather is particularly bad, there's a system called SWEP, Severe Weather Emergency Protocol, which is activated by the local authority. So the hospital getting themselves on the SWEP list of when that's going to be on, because most areas will take anybody who's rough sleeping in for the night. If the temperature is due to feel below zero, they will take people in until the temperature increases a bit, and that can be a good way of getting people an initial contact with services. And then practical things like having a store of food that people can take away, drinks, warm clothes, socks, shoes, underwear, things like that. The things that get kind of ruined when people come into hospital, it's really, really useful if you've got those: warm coats, warm hats, sleeping bags, that type of thing. Having all of those can really, you know, those, it doesn't sound like much, but it can be a lifesaver for somebody on a cold night.
Yeah, it makes a big difference, you know, what you've mentioned there. And gosh, some really interesting information there, because a lot, I know our listeners won't know about, you know, the street map and the, you know, being able to, you know, the cold weather and everything, because it is so important, isn't it? These people suffer enough, so it's such a difficult thing. And quick question that I just thought about there, you mentioned, you know, healthcare professionals maybe not asking the question, individuals feeling maybe embarrassed, they've got a stigma, they may feel that they smell, and the odor in the waiting room. I've heard this through, you know, the lived experience as well. Do people feel that they don't want to approach you, or is that something that doesn't happen? You know, are people too embarrassed to seek out help?
Sometimes. I think sometimes people have tried to seek help in the past and it hasn't worked out well. So I think if, you know, somebody tries to go and register with a GP, I'm a GP by background, so if they try and go register at GP surgery and they're turned away, they're likely not to go back. They probably won't go back anywhere. So certainly during the pandemic, when the Everyone In was on and there were hotels opened up for people experiencing homelessness, we saw lots of people who'd not seen a healthcare professional for many, many years, you know, 5 years, 10 years. And sometimes that was because they've been turned away from somewhere. So that's why people experiencing homelessness often turn up in kind of extreme circumstances with their health, because they try not to seek help. And so it gets to a point where they can't not seek help anymore. That's when they turn up. It's also why there's higher rates of use of emergency services rather than planned services, because people leave it and leave it and leave it and leave it. Sometimes because they're worried about the kind of reception that they're going to get. And I think you don't have to do that much to get over that. It was just treating people with respect. It's being interested, ignoring, you know, if there is anything like an odour, just ignore that. You know, we're used to seeing worse than that as healthcare professionals, aren't we? Showing some interest in the person, so just asking them about their circumstances. just asking if you've got a safe place to stay tonight can sort of open up the conversation without saying, are you experiencing homelessness? So all of those things that we sort of do to sort of build rapport with people and just speak to people in a kind of, in a normal way, not in a clinical way, and just speak to people in sort of common language rather than medical language can really help to kind of demystify things as well. Treating people on a kind of equal footing, not talking down to people, not being condescending. Nobody likes being, people speak to them in a condescending way. And people experiencing homelessness are no different from that.
And it's to treat everyone like an individual. And, if you're in the healthcare professional, we do that, or, and it's important to treat people, with respect and dignity, whatever the situation, it's really important. And like you say, some, again, good advice, to not over medicalize it, and, talk in normal to make them feel comfortable, eye contact, and, sort of reducing that sort of feeling of stigma and situation that they're in. So yeah, really good
And I
advice.
think asking those questions, because although there are high rates of alcohol dependence and drug dependence in the population, and there's high rates of mental illness, that's by no means everybody. So there are plenty of people experiencing homelessness around who haven't got any of those issues at all. And it's not nice to be bundled together into groups if you're not one of those groups. So just ask people, and they'll if you ask them a straight question, they'll usually give you a straight answer.
Yeah, it can happen to anyone these days, and that's the situation, isn't it? And I know, even having experience working in A&E in the past, or the ED department, you should say now, it can happen to absolutely anyone, and anyone can be felt in this situation. And when you delve a bit like delve a bit deeper into this person's life, they could have had a very respectful job and respectful family. It's just circumstances that can happen. And
And the other side of that, of course, is that some people are kind of born into difficult circumstances, they experience a lot of trauma as children, more trauma as adults, and that's why they've ended up in the situation that they're in. Whether that involves homelessness or drug use or sex work or whatever it might be, but that doesn't mean there's something sort of wrong about them. It's just how the situation's worked out for them, and we'd all be the same if we'd been born in those situations, had those same experiences. So I think, people who become clinical people in hospitals usually have, gone to university and gone through medical school and done quite well in life because of the start that they've had. Not everybody, there are exceptions, but I think if you put yourself in that situation, well, what if I'd being in their situation to start with, then where would my life have gone? And it probably would have gone down a very different path.
Yeah, it is that sliding doors, isn't it, really? And put yourself into different situations, and it is, once people are on that sort of situation, it can be very, very tricky and very difficult to get out of sometimes as well, without support and without help. Another quick question about the charity. I mean, how does it work? How do you fund? How does it work that way?
So we have our pathway partnership program that I've spoken about with the inReach teams into the hospital, but we also work to try and influence sort of government policy. We try to generally help with inclusion health issues all over the place. We have a conference every year where we invite everybody who's working in inclusion health to come along and present about their work. We have, educational classes. We have various different, so we have the faculty, which is our membership organisation, which has 2,500 members, all of whom are in some way involved in inclusion health. So they may be people who've been homeless themselves in the past. They may be commissioners of inclusion health services, clinicians, everybody in between. And we have various different subgroups as well, so people can meet each other and swap ideas and learn from each other. So we have primary care subgroup, we've got a system leaders and managers subgroup, we've got a mobile services subgroup, a nurses group, trying to think of them all now, an education one. So we're interested in how, you know, people who are training and being educated learn about inclusion health, you know, when health professionals are being trained. We've just starting a new group for, there's a new group started last year from about nutrition, because that's very, very important and a sort of neglected area in health and homelessness. And we're just starting a professionals in training group, so that people who are in train, so we've, and a students group. So we've had a students group, we've got the groups of people who are trained, and we're trying to fill in the gap in the middle with people who are in training. So some of those are national groups, some of them are regional. So we're really trying to sort of bring people together, learn from them, and help them learn from each other as well.
It's a huge amount of groups. Amazing. I mean, amazing what you've got there.
Yeah, we try to sort of cover everybody, because I think that's a large part of it, is it can be quite isolating work doing this work as well. So it's very isolating being in an inclusion health group, but it's also can be isolating, and there can be a bit of stigma towards people who work in this area as well. You know, we get called names too in the hospital.
Really? Gosh, never thought of that actually. Yeah.
Yeah, it does happen. So it's to provide a place for people who have the sort of similar aims, wanting to do the same things in inclusion health, to sort of come together and get some strength from being with other people who feel the same.
And the support from each other, which is important, isn't it? And, you know, we all need that safeguarding as well as the individuals that are experiencing the situation as well. So really important. You mentioned a conference there. Is that an annual conference that you...
It is an annual, yeah. We have an annual two-day... Yeah, we have an annual two-day international conference, usually in March. So this year it's at, excuse me, a place called International Student House in London. So we have, I can tell you the dates, I think it's 18th and 19th of March this year. So we have people coming from all around the world, really, to come and meet together, mainly UK people. And each year we put out a call for people to come and present either a new idea they've had, or some work that they've been doing, or a new piece of research. So we have 2 days. There's usually about 400 people there each day. And it's the kind of highlight of the inclusion health year, getting everybody together and learning new things. And that, again, it kind of helps to energize people for the year ahead. You know, it's difficult working in any sort of health service these days. It's particularly difficult working in inclusion health. Funding's always uncertain. We never quite know what's happening from one year to the next. So it really helps people sort of join together and get strength from each other.
Yeah, it sounds really important that definitely is needed. And, you know, it's amazing that it's, you know, international as well, that, you know, people from all over the world join. So absolutely well done to you guys. Amazing work that you do. I mean, this has really opened my eyes a lot, having spoken to yourself, Chris, but, you know, also your colleagues as well. And, you know, it's really opened my eyes, and I'm sure it will for our listeners as well. For our listeners today, I mean, if they wanted to get involved or they wanted to be part of, is that possible? Is that something that they can do or reach out?
Yeah, definitely. So if they're people who are interested in having sort of looking at the issue in their area, we do work like undertake needs assessments for particular areas. If they want to, you know, if they want to fund us to do that, we undertake consultancy work as well, if they want to look at a particular issue, as well as supporting the Pathway Partnership program teams. And then for people, if they want to join in and join the faculty, faculty is free to join. We ask for a contribution of £25 a year towards the running costs from people who are on a reasonable income, £10 a year from people on low income, no contribution expected from people with lived experience or students or people on benefits. They do that by going to the Pathway website, which is www.pathway.org.uk, looking for the faculty button and then join the faculty. If they send us a message through that, then they'll be put onto the faculty list, which means they'll be told about the meetings that are coming up. They'll also get our newsletter once every 2 weeks, which has news about new papers that have come out, new events that are happening around the country. We put job adverts in there for inclusion health posts as well. So just keeping up to date with everything that's happening in the inclusion health world.
A great thing to, you know, promote, Julie, because again, that's something I would have not known that was available to, you know, everyone. So that's really, really positive as well. Is there any other key aspects before we close on this podcast today, Chris, anything that you would like to get the message across or anything to discuss? It's been a huge learning curve for myself, and I'm sure a lot of our listeners here today as well.
I think the thing would be to sort of think in advance about how you'd make those contacts with other people, perhaps outside of hospital if you work in a hospital, and inside a hospital if you work outside. So think about making contacts with your local housing department, your local GP that delivers healthcare for people experiencing homes in the community, your local day centre, things like that, because, you know, you may need those contacts in the future. And then if you've already sort of met those people, you already know who they are, it's a lot easier than when you need to be in contact with them about patients. So I think sort of building your network and making your network connections is probably the first step to making things better for the patients.
It's great advice. And I think then as a clinician as well, you become, you know, you're more confident, you can open up that conversation, you can ask the question that you maybe have been apprehensive, because you have, you know, you may not be able to change everything, but you can actually signpost and actually, you know, give some help as well. And also for that individual, you know, just to be listened to and, you know, yeah, offered some support, that makes a big, big difference, definitely.
Yeah. Yeah, people often say that they feel kind of ignored and invisible. And I think if you can show some interest in the person as an individual, then that goes a long way to you know, getting over that issue.
Yeah, absolutely, 100%. Well, I can't thank you enough, Chris,
thank
for
you.
Today. It's absolutely fantastic. And, you know, I'm sure we'll be doing some more work with you and your team over the coming months as well. We're always here to, you know, support yourselves. And it's a massive
thank
help
you
to our listeners today as well, because it is a minefield that, you know, we're not quite sure sometimes what to say and what to do and where to signpost. So it's really, really important that we, you know, it's definitely made my job a lot easier and just investigating what is available in the area, and not to ignore that question. So it's really important. So thank you very much. We will have some links with these various podcasts attached to, and also I'm sure in the future we will be doing some more work on this project as well. So thanks again, Chris. Thanks very much
thank
for
you.
Joining us today.
Great to see you again.
Brilliant.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed this episode. For further information on the BDNG, visit our website bdng.org.uk and watch out for the next BDNG podcast, which is coming soon.